This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 716-748-0144, or if you have a computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the United States and Canada, 888-429-5471. Joining me tonight, Dr. Kevin Barrett. He is a PhD Arabist Islamist. He holds advanced degrees in English, French, and African literature. He is an author of three books, including Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama's Voters. Dr. Barrett also was a lead editor, along with John Cobb and Sandra Labarsky, of 9-1-1, The American Empire, and also Christians and Muslims Speak Out. Kevin, welcome to The People Speak.
Hey, thanks, Rock. It's good to be here.
Kevin, fill us in about yourself, and I know you converted to Islam, and what directed you to the conversion, and then we'll go in on the Charlie Hebdo and everything else afterwards. Just give us a briefing on yourself real quick.
Sure, yeah. Well, I grew up among pretty secular types, lapsed Unitarians in a sense. I went to Unitarian church a couple times when I was a kid. And when I woke up to the spiritual dimension of reality when I was a teenager, I didn't really have any traditional framework to put that in, besides the hippy-dippy framework that was all around me. So I got interested in Zen and things like that, and trying to find meaning in life, as a lot of folks do in their 20s. And along the way, I got interested in the traditionalists. The traditionalists are people, mostly Europeans, who got suddenly woke up to the perils and pitfalls of secular modernity and the value of traditionally based spiritualities. And most of these people became Muslims. People like René Guénon, who was the founder of traditionalism, had a terrific influence on the religious studies departments. And so I ran into those people and got kind of interested. I noticed that they were Muslims, which seemed kind of strange to me because I had all of the usual misinformation about Islam. But then I ended up having some very interesting experiences, visions, and bizarre synchronicities that made me realize that actually Islam gets monotheism right. You know, the problems with Judaism and Christianity, which, I mean, both are legitimate, but Judaism remains kind of a tribal god. You know, they have a tribal god and a kind of a tribal mentality. And Christianity, which has all sorts of wonderful aspects, and the message of Jesus, peace upon him, is eternal for the ages and, you know, has never really been surpassed. But traditional Christianity often, sees a flawed universe. God is like an old man with a beard. Jesus is the Son. God's the Father. This sort of thing, which is very mythological and obviously just, let's face it, not true. It's mythology. Islam demythologizes God. The Godhead of Christianity is pretty much the same kind of idea as God or Allah in Islam. So it basically throws out all of the superstitions, shibboleths, and myths of the earlier versions of monotheism that were basically right but kind of went astray somewhere. And I figured that out in the early 90s and came to Islam in 1993. And I've been praying, putting my forehead on the floor in absolute submission to the true creator of all of the universes ever since.
Right. Well, in my studies, I found out that, Allah is actually the root word in all three languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Arabic, that it is the word for God.
That's Jesus said Allah when he was talking about God.
Yes, correct. Anyway, let's move on and talk about the sniper and Hebdo Charlie and all this Islamophobia that's going on.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that they decided to replace the lost communist enemy of the Cold War with Islam, a religion with 2 billion adherents that's been around for 1,400 years. And they're not letting up. You know, 9/11 was the product launch, but the war on Islam was actually designed at the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in 1979. That event was convened by Netanyahu himself, and he brought George H.W. Bush, Henry Jackson, a whole bunch of high-level movers and shakers over to Jerusalem, and they sat down and said, okay, you know, we're going to make the next big enemy of the West, quote-unquote, terrorism. And, of course, from Netanyahu's perspective, that means Islam. So in 1979, they actually had this conference which drafted the whole program of making Islam the next big enemy. And as I said, the real product launch was the public relations stunt of September 11th, 2001. And then they keep the pot boiling with all of these other alleged radical Muslim attacks, most of which are either fabricated or the people behind the attacks are really patsies of Western intelligence services.
Paid mercenaries, in other words.
Yeah, mercenaries, dupes. Webster Tarpley gives us a pretty good working model in his book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror. And he talks about how there are moles, dupes, and patsies. The moles are people like Wolfowitz and Cheney, perhaps, people who work their way up into high positions but actually are working with these rogue networks responsible for terrorism. The patsies are the people that get blamed for terrorism, like the 19 guys they blamed for 9/11 who actually didn't do it. And the dupes are people who may believe in what they're doing, but they're just pawns in somebody else's game. And some of the alleged Islamic terrorists are like that. For instance, the retarded teenagers that the FBI sells on some terror plot. You know, the FBI finds a psychopathic informant who wants leniency in his sentencing or wants some money, and they get that guy to go and find a retarded Muslim teenager somewhere and try to coerce him into accepting joining the FBI's own terror plot. And virtually all of the terror prosecutions against Muslims since 9/11 have been on that model.
And even prior to 9/11, I believe it was the same with the original 93 bombing of the World Trade Center.
Well, that's right. We actually have on tape the FBI informant who organized all of the logistics of that bombing on behalf of the FBI, talking with his FBI handler, saying, I thought you guys were going to give us a dud bomb. You know, why did you use a real bomb? I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Okay, and what are your thoughts about Sniper in the movie, and why are they bringing out this movie? To me, it's a good movie, well played out and everything else, but I see it as I don't know if people are going to agree with me or not. I see it as a terroristic movie in a sense, because all I see is people being terrorized. But here in America, it seems like they're seeing it in a different fashion. And why do you think that is so?
Well, I see this as genocide propaganda. And Hollywood has been pumping out genocide propaganda for some time, but it's gotten a lot worse post 9/11. And, of course, it's a good story and so on. It's a Hollywood story. But ultimately, the subliminal or maybe even not so subliminal message is hey, it's great to murder Muslims. That's really what it's about.
Yeah, it's great to murder in general.
Yeah, you know? Well, no, I think they're specifically scapegoating Muslims, of course. You know, there's a scapegoating reflex in the human psyche. We have this need to unite against an enemy and to blame somebody for our own problems. And, you know, lynchings and witch hunts and such phenomena have been going on throughout the ages. There's a philosopher named René Girard who's done terrific work on this. And right now there's a very, very orchestrated multi-billion-dollar international effort to incite a genocide against Muslims. And the people who are doing this, such as the producers of this movie, are all at least as guilty as Dr. Goebbels ever was. He had to commit suicide to avoid being hanged at Nuremberg. And all these people really deserve the same fate.
Yeah, we do have a collaboration of a lot of very, very evil people. Charlie Hebdo. Let's move on to that. You know, the incitement of the cartoons and everything else. That's all intentionally done so they can create a reaction, so they can blame it once again on Islam.
Yeah, I think this particular false flag had a number of uses, and it involved probably collaboration between NATO, which is, it runs Operation Gladio, which is a false flag terror program operating in Europe on behalf of NATO, and the Israeli Zionist Axis. And I think those two groups apparently worked together to some extent to produce the Charlie Hebdo massacre. And what they gained was the NATO side was pressuring France. France has always been the odd man out in NATO. They've always insisted on being somewhat independent, going back to De Gaulle, who was the hero of independent-minded French foreign policy. He pulled out of NATO. He built French, you know, a French nuclear weapon that was not under the command of NATO. Now, NATO, which is essentially the unified U.S. occupation of Europe, and of course, on behalf of the international banksters, so it's not really American, but it's through the American command, has always tried to maintain this kind of colonial occupation of Europe, and they've used false flag terror to do this. During the Cold War, virtually all of the terrorism in Europe, such as the Red Brigades and so on, that was blamed on leftists, was actually perpetrated by the U.S. NATO command structure. And that's all been proven seven ways from Sunday. Professor Daniel Ganser in Switzerland has written books and books on it. The European Parliament has admitted this. And yet, today, when something exactly like all of that 1970s and 80s NATO Operation Gladio terror happens in Paris, the European media tries to make Europeans forget about this. So NATO was pressuring France because France has been cutting deals with Russia, has been refusing to go along with the NATO war on Russia. France has voted to recognize Palestine, which infuriated Netanyahu. And France has in other ways asserted its independence. Hollande was becoming a real problem for the masters of the empire. And so they and their Gladio network under U.S. military command worked with the Israelis, who are the world's top experts in producing false flag terror attacks to blame on Muslims. And they created this stunt. They went and used their own assets. Whether or not it was the guys they blamed, I don't know. But certainly this was a very, you know, very well-trained military-style operation. It was special forces people that did it. Whether they brainwashed and trained the guys that they blamed for it or whether it was somebody else who actually did the shooting, we don't really know yet. But what we do know is this was not angry Muslims who were unhappy about pictures of Muhammad. This was U.S., NATO, Israeli terrorists who murdered those people.
Right, but I, you know, I was looking at the video and being former military, I realized that you know, point blank in the head, an AK-47 rips apart a head like a watermelon. I didn't see any blood or anything on that video, so maybe it was a big, you know, green screen acted out situation there in France. Mm-hmm. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Barrett, author, writer here on The People Speak with your host, Rock Cash, on the BBS Radio Network. We're talking about American Sniper, Charlie Hebdo cartoons, and Islamophobia. Doc, what do you foresee as another outcome that might happen just to send everybody off to war, get Americans more incited, and basically create chaos here in the United States?
Well, we've already got a certain level of chaos going here in the United States, but they might want to increase that as a pretext for more of a crackdown if they start to feel that they're losing control. You know, it's all contingency plans, I think. You know, there's some folks who believe that there's some kind of New World Order elite out there that is planning to lock us all up in FEMA camps and ultimately put microchips in our brains. And although I wouldn't put that past them, I think that the FEMA camps, which are indeed built, they have camps that are ready to take, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of people. But that's all contingency planning. I think the powers that be recognize that there's a lot of chaos coming down the pipe. Number one, the empire, by which I mean the bankster-run empire that uses the U.S. military to enforce its edicts, has reached the end of its rope. And they're quite desperate. Really, the only way they could maintain the current level of imperial control, much less extended over the entire globe, which is their ultimate objective, would be to have a third world war. And the globe after the third world war might not be worth very much. So they're in a real fix. And I think they're increasingly turning to these Orwellian social control methods of fear-mongering, scapegoating, and so on, because the old social control methods of hope and distractions and entertainment, yeah, there's still some of that around. You know, we're still amusing ourselves to death, as Neil Postman said. But I think we're moving into a more Orwellian world now as the powers that be face the fact that there's going to be a period in which there's not much economic growth. We may even see a lot of negative growth, possibly for the rest of our lifetimes. If the climate change alarmists are actually right, which is quite possible, the world might become a lot less inhabitable in the near future. And that could lead to all kinds of chaos, including wars and rumors of wars as countries fight over resources, food supplies, water supplies, as well as energy supplies. And I think they're getting ready for all that. And, you know, so if the standard of living in the U.S. collapses, it's possible that the powers that be would try to head off internal chaos by uniting against an external enemy, and then they would lock up the dissidents just to try to keep that unanimity going. So that's the kind of stuff that they're looking ahead towards. It isn't very pretty, but I think we need to face that and then think really hard about whether there might be a way that we can really break from this very negative and doomed trajectory and come up with something better.
Right. I've got a question from a audience member. Jessa in the USA wants to know why the United Nations does not stop the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Well, that's an interesting question. And if the United Nations were really a democratic or even semi-democratic unity of, you know, or union of nations in which all the nations had a voice and they would theoretically try to resolve problems according to justice primarily, the Palestine situation would have, well, it never would have happened because, you know, that nobody would have ever tolerated this genocide. Because that's what it is. It's an invasion, occupation, ethnic cleansing, and genocide of Palestine by an external invader. These psychotic, brainwashed, ultra-ethnic, militaristic, nationalistic Zionists who, you know, this movement was a European nationalist movement like the other European nationalist movements, except it didn't have a territory, and it was based on a very, very strong kind of tribal cohesion in the Jewish community. And even so, the Jewish community didn't unite behind Zionism up until World War II. And then with the fear factor of the Holocaust, they got this insane amount of, you know, ultra-tribal cohesion going. And the elites of the world Jewish community have managed to brainwash the masses of Jewish people and turning them into just psychopathic soldiers of Zionist empire and genocide. And so there's this insane situation in Palestine now where, you know, this is holy land that's been basically administered pretty nicely, really, by Muslims ever since Islam existed, you know, starting almost 1,400 years ago. And it's now the site of a genocide against not just Muslims, but also Christians. And we have an apartheid ethnic superiority state that's far worse than anything in Southern Africa ever was. And yet the world is letting it go. And I think the reason that it's been allowed to happen and that we're still allowing it to happen is that the Zionists have so much power. You know, half the billionaires in America are Jewish, and they're all hardline Zionists. Almost the entire mainstream media is owned by hardline Jewish Zionists. Hollywood is completely dominated by hardline Jewish Zionists. And they admit it. It's not like this is some big secret, although even as many Jewish people in Hollywood, like Joel Stein, admit that Hollywood is completely run lock, stock, and barrel by Zionist Jews, the Anti-Defamation League will attack you as an anti-Semite if you mention this fact, which is a fact. Nobody disputes it. Not even the ADL would dispute it. They just don't want you to say it. And so this is why the Israel-Palestine situation grinds on, because of Zionist power. And it won't end until we take Zionist power down several notches.
Okay, I got another question from Jane in California. She wants to know why Obama never mentions Rothschild when he talked about Charlie Hebdo.
Well, what specifically about Rothschild was Obama supposed to mention in connection to Charlie Hebdo?
She's just wondering why Obama didn't mention the Rothschilds. I guess it's coming out as a joke, but
Well, actually, you know, I believe the Rothschilds did buy up Charlie Hebdo is probably what she's referring to, because they owned Liberation, or Libération, which used to be a left-wing independent publication in France. And I think Libération bought up Charlie Hebdo, and the Rothschilds then bought Libération. But more importantly was that the editor, or I forget, owner, editor, whatever it was, the guy in charge of Charlie Hebdo was a hardline Zionist. So, yeah, it's true that the Rothschilds did buy it at some point, I think several years ago, indirectly through Libération. And then the guy who took over at Charlie Hebdo is a hardline Zionist. And so ever since then, they've been basically just, you know, going after Muslims and at the same time refusing to go after Israel or Jews or anybody else with the same ferocity.
Well, I'm guessing that's why Zionists showed up in scores in Los Angeles to protest, you know, against the Charlie Hebdo incident.
It was obviously orchestrated. I mean, I can't believe that somebody independently came up with this idea of "We are Charlie Hebdo," and they got all those identical signs printed up. That whole thing was, you know, it's just like when they knew who the, you know, they knew that Bin Laden did 9/11. You know, 5 minutes after the first image of the tower, you know, with smoke pouring out of it showed up on TV, come Israelis on television telling us that it must have been Bin Laden. And then the whole U.S. media echo chamber keeps saying Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden. And the next day they get the names of the 19 patsies, and they haven't changed those names, even though 10 of them turned up alive. Likewise with Charlie Hebdo, this thing is, it's just way, way too pat that such a perfect public relations stunt happens, and then instantly the whole country is mobilized with government-supported demonstrations, all of these identical signs printed up. The slogan was probably written beforehand. You know, it's got to be one of those pre-scripted things, just like 9/11. Philip Zelikow, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission and who was completely responsible for the 9/11 Commission report, which he wrote before the commission even convened, probably was the script writer for 9/11 itself. He's an expert in the creation and maintenance of public myths, and he wrote an article about the likely consequences of a new Pearl Harbor, such as the destruction of the World Trade Center, and he published that article back in 1998, just 3 years early. So they pre-script these things so they can get the reaction they want. They figure out exactly what the media is going to have to say to mobilize people, and I'm sure that Charlie Hebdo was no exception.
Justin in the USA again wants to know if there is an unstated policy to target and kill Muslims by the USA.
Well, of course. The U.S. has killed probably about 1.5 million Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11. The low-end estimate there would be a little under 1 million, but it's probably a lot more than that. And then ruined the lives of many millions more who've been made refugees, homeless, and destitute. And all of this is clearly based on creating an enemy image of Muslims by way of the public relations stunt on 9/11. So we're seeing a worldwide genocide against Islam that includes mass murder in the millions, all based on a big lie on 9/11. I mean, this is in some ways far beyond even, you know, the worst that Hitler did, according to his worst detractors. The level of lying here is just so far off the charts that it's hard for a lot of people to even wrap their minds around it.
Right. Even former prosecutor Vince Bugliosi came out with a movie stating that, or the book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Lying on the Iraq War and the Weapons of Mass Destruction and sending
for murder, actually. Yes. The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder was the title.
Right. Yeah. Also, Omar in Ohio, Kevin, what do you think the U.S. has killed over 3 million Muslims since the attack of 9/11? What do you think the most accurate number is?
Well, again, I said 1.5 million, and I think that's pretty conservative. But you can find a range of estimates. It's hard sometimes to tell whether, you know, you're just counting people who've been shot, you know, people who have died because the water system has been destroyed and they're drinking bad water. A lot of children have died that way. People, babies who die from depleted uranium, birth defects. But I think some of the best work on this has been done by Dr. Gideon Polla, he's an Australian physician who studied the whole history of U.S. and British interventions in Iraq. And as I recall, he counted up since 1950, which is when the U.S. and Britain started really installing their puppet dictators and, you know, leading to a lot of deaths. Although there were a lot of deaths in Iraq from British bombing and stuff back in the 20s. But starting in 1950, according to Polya, the U.S. and Britain together have killed something like 8 million Iraqis. And that includes the 500,000 Iraqi children that were murdered through sanctions in the 1990s, which Madeleine Albright basically bragged about. She was asked, do you think killing 500,000 children is worth it? And she said, yes, we do think it's worth it. So these people are, you know, everything that they, you know, they claim people like Hitler and Stalin were, if not worse.
Correct. Well, I remember reading about General Patton saying something that the German people were the victims in World War II.
Well, one of my friends at Veterans Today think Patton was assassinated for that reason. You know, after World War II, as many as over 1 million German prisoners of war were deliberately starved to death by the U.S. occupation forces behind barbed wire. Eisenhower was responsible for that. Patton didn't like it. And according to researchers I've talked to, they think Patton was murdered because of that.
Right, because he was planning on running for president, from what I understand. Right.
Yeah, yeah. These people who actually have a shot at changing things tend to get killed. You know, it's nice that somebody like me, who's just basically a lone nut, you know, I have an audience that sometimes reaches up into six figures if I have something that goes viral. But I don't think I'm enough of a pest that they really have to deal with me very harshly, at least. I kind of hope not. but, you know, these people who actually are in a position to really change things, like Patton, like Roosevelt, who was going to push through an economic bill of rights, so they poisoned him. Like Martin Luther King Jr., who was murdered so he wouldn't bring 500,000 people to Washington and refused to go home till the Vietnam War was ended and poverty was ended. And people like John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, who were both on a path to peace, wanted to bust up the secret societies that run our government. People like Senator Paul Wellstone, who was in the position to get a real investigation of 9/11 and to stop the Iraq war before it started, was murdered along with his wife and daughter in a rigged plane crash by Dick Cheney in 2002. I mean, these are people who actually are in a position to change something, and they get killed. You know, Hugo Chavez is given cancer, CIA cancer. They tried to kill Castro hundreds of times, and somehow his bodyguards must have been geniuses. Never happened. You know, we like to think that we live in such a nice liberal democratic country, but it's really just another police state. But it's a little bit kinder and gentler than some of the police states, because they won't just come and kick in your door and shoot you in the head simply for saying things they don't like. It's only if you actually pose a threat to their power that they do things like that.
Awesome. We're going to need to take a quick break. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Barrett, author, writer, here on The People Speak with your host, Rock Cash, on the BBS Radio Network. We'll be right back in the jiffy.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
We're back on The People Speak. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Barrett, author, writer, here on the BBS Radio Network. We'll be talking about Charlie Hebdo, Islamophobia, and of course, The American Sniper. This movie that I perceive to be just a major lie. Dr. Barrett, you were fired from the University of Nebraska, I believe it was?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, okay. Can you tell us why you were fired?
Well, you know, I wasn't exactly fired. I was just not rehired because I was on semester-to-semester contract. And in a way, that was a victory because the neocon Republican witch hunt was designed to try to get me fired while I was in the middle of teaching a class on Islam. And what they didn't like was that in the 16-week class, there was 1 week devoted to the so-called war on terror. And during that week, I was presenting some different perspectives, including the majority Muslim perspective, which is that it was an inside job. But I was also presenting, you know, Bernard Lewis, neocons. I was presenting some, you know, much more sort of middle of the road analyses. John Esposito, who's a kind of a middle of the road Islamic studies guy. I wasn't even going to be hammering on the 9/11 truth angle at all. But even just having that in there was enough for them to use it as an excuse to make an example of me. I mean, I think the purpose of the whole thing was to scare off other professors from talking about 9/11 in a way they didn't appreciate. Because at that point in June of 2006, we had over 100 professors at different universities, mostly in the U.S., who were convinced that 9/11 was an inside job and starting to do research and activism on that. So to try to stop that process in June 2006, Karl Rove and Lynn Cheney, who appear to have been the principals, got Fox News involved in looking for some evil conspiracy professor to make a bad example of, to scare the other professors away. And the first one they grabbed was Jim Fetzer, who was teaching at University of Minnesota. And they brought him on Fox News with Ollie North. And Jim did a great job basically just hammering Ollie North and making a fool of him. So that didn't work. And then they said, well, let's try this other guy, this Barrett guy, who's, you know, making all kinds of waves in the 9/11 truth movement, you know, getting David Ray Griffin on C-SPAN and stuff like that. So they then ambushed me and again tried to use the same script, which is to claim that I was inflicting evil conspiracy theories on my students, which I most certainly wasn't. But I did use the occasion to try to educate the public about 9/11 truth. I fought back with everything I had and did manage to help gain a fair amount of attention for that issue. But the problem was that this meant that I became toxic from the university's perspective. They lost $500,000 in one day after I was on the Hannity and Combs show in canceled contributions. Those were just private donations. And you can bet that the government was going to tighten some purse strings as well to send the message. So the university administration basically knew that they were going to lose millions of dollars if they kept me around, and naturally they didn't. And I can't get hired in any mainstream American institution for that reason. All they do is Google me, and they realize that they're going to get hammered if they hire me. So I'm effectively blacklisted, and I have to earn my living in alternative journalism and writing books, doing radio shows and things like that, which is not, at this point, quite as lucrative as even a teaching job.
Well, yeah, I can only imagine how, you know, a lot of people really aren't going out there and buying the books. Go ahead and plug in your blog and your website and where they can get your books so we can get it out there so people can actually look at your material.
Sure. Yeah, my website is truthjihad.com. And people who want to help out and support the Truth Jihad can subscribe there and become a member and help support the radio shows for $3.95 a month. That's you'll get the radio shows extra early and some other stuff, such as free downloads that other people don't get. I also have some books out. There's Truth Jihad, which is a kind of a humorous autobiographical look at how, you know, a nice Midwestern white boy like me turned into a extremist Muslim conspiracy theorist. And so that's, yeah, I hope it's somewhat entertaining. And then there's the serious ones, Questioning the War on Terror, which is my Socratic deconstruction of the whole concept of the War on Terror. And then there's 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Jews, Christians, and Muslims Speak Out. And that's the one I edited along with John Cobb, who's one of our top theologians, and Sandra Lubarsky, who's a Jewish studies professor. And I'm working on a similar book right now on Charlie Hebdo, bringing together a whole lot of pretty well-known names saying, we are not Charlie Hebdo. So that book should be out within a few months, God willing.
Good. God willing, we'll have you back then to go over it. It'll be a fun show. Ivan in Germany wants to know what you think will happen now with the Hermit Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Good question. You know, I kind of wish it would just dissolve and it would just become Arabia instead of Saudi Arabia. You know, having the country named after its ruling crime family, it's like, hey, it's if we renamed our country Bushy America. You know, it's kind of embarrassing. I feel sorry for the people there. The Ibn Saud family is one of the most notoriously corrupt and just, you know, short-sighted, utterly incompetent bunch of bozos who essentially are running that place on behalf of the bankster empire. They have a deal where, you know, they get to put billions of dollars in their Swiss bank accounts. They get to fly around the world gambling and chasing prostitutes and drugs and doing all the un-Islamic things they want. And all they have to do in return is to allow the U.S. to run their military and intelligence services and to dictate their oil pricing policy. So they're really just a puppet state of the United States. And they chop off heads like crazy. And that's your tax dollars at work, folks. It's American tax dollars that are really running Saudi Arabia. And so your tax dollars are chopping off those heads in Chop Chop Square. Well, now that King Abdullah is gone, and he was not the worst of them by any means. Who knows what's going to happen next? I would like to think that some relatively enlightened and populist sort of Islamic democratic movement, somewhat like the Iranian revolutionaries, could make the same kind of changes in Saudi Arabia. Basically, I think every country in the world, not just Islamic countries, but every country needs a revolution along the lines of the Iranian Islamic Revolution. They need to reconnect with their heritage. They need to kick out the imperial control apparatus, the military bases, the torture chambers. Shah of Iran was a CIA puppet who, you know, let the CIA build his torture chambers and tortured and murdered thousands of dissidents. Every country should throw out those CIA controllers. They should throw out the banksters, regain control over their own currency. Saudi Arabia should be the first country to do that. You know, they're supposedly protecting the holy places of Islam, and yet right now they are playing a key role in propping up the usurious bankster empire that's based on usury. That's one of the worst sins, if not the worst sin, in not just Islam but in Christianity as well. And yet these supposed Muslim rulers who are living anything but Islamic lives are just the core of the corrupt system that we have now. They're puppets of the Rothschilds and those people. So we need an Iranian-style revolution in Saudi Arabia. Whether it's going to happen anytime soon, I really don't know. Unfortunately, the empire has dumped people down there as everywhere else. So there are all sorts of, you know, Wahhabi, narrow-minded, obscurantist idiots posing as hardcore Muslims in Saudi Arabia. These are the people supporting ISIS and things like that. These are all just imperial puppet things. You know, what we need is a more sophisticated Iranian-style revolution there that would separate Saudi Arabia from the U.S. bankster empire, and that would help end the empire and its dreams of a world government, which is the number one task today. We need to stop these bankster criminals from imposing their tyranny on the entire world. We need to help the world rebel against this. We need to support everybody who is standing up against the bankster empire, whether it's Putin over in Russia. He's not perfect, but at least he's got his oligarchs under a certain amount of control. We need to support the Iranians who are heroically holding off this bankster empire. We need to support, heck, maybe even North Korea, although that might be pushing it a little bit, but at least they're not part of this thing. We need to support Cuba, Venezuela, every country that stands up against this empire, kicks the economic hitmen and the real hitmen and the military bases out of their territory, reasserts control over their country and over their currency. Anybody who does that is a hero, and we should all be ready to sacrifice everything to make that resistance against the bankster empire successful.
Well, here on the People Speaking, the BBS radio network, your voice is heard all the way around the world. We've got a caller from Australia. Steve, are you there?
Good evening, Dr. Barrett. My name is Steve Johnson from Stop Funding Israel in Australia. I'm a longtime fan of over 10 years, and I'm following also No Lies regularly, No Lies Radio. My question for you is regarding Rebecca Roth and her recent incredible information about 9/11. What is it particularly about her information that really blew you away the most? Can you elaborate?
Sure, yeah. Rebecca Roth is a former stewardess who just put out this fascinating book, Methodical Illusion. It's a potboiler thriller of a novel. And frankly, it's not, you know, brilliant from a stylistic perspective, but it's a good read. It's fun. It'd be fun even if it didn't have that 9/11 truth. And wow, you know, what really blew me away the most was I think she solved the million-dollar question of what happened to the planes and the passengers. And that's been a question that's been, you know, used to bludgeon anybody who stands up for 9/11 truth and says, look, there's no evidence of any big plane crash at the Pentagon. There's no evidence of any big plane crash at Shanksville, Pennsylvania. There's just an empty hole in the ground. And there's not even any real evidence of actual airliner crashes at the Twin Towers either, except for these somewhat dubious videos. So where did these planes go and what happened to the passengers? And I have always said, well, the complicit ones were handed their payoff and maybe some ID papers or even some plastic surgery. If, you know, maybe they were all complicit, I don't know. Or the non-complicit ones were killed. And, you know, the planes landed somewhere. This is what I've been saying for years. Well, Rebecca Roth has filled in the blanks and showed us where the planes landed and how it was done. And I'm 80% sure that she's right about at least the fact that these planes must have been captured by FTS, Flight Termination System, which has been installed on our airliners and is one reason why there has not ever been a successful hijacking in the United States since the 1970s. And this FTS system takes over the plane in the event of an emergency or hijacking, and it shuts down all communications equipment, and then the plane can be flown from the ground. So what happened was these planes took off. They were immediately taken over by FTS, and then they were flown to a military base. Rebecca names the military base. I won't name it because, number one, I don't remember right now. But number two, she wants you to read the book. So they landed at a military base less than 20 minutes after takeoff. The handlers, that is, there on each flight, there would have been a couple of paramilitary types who were in charge of making sure that the passengers were sort of shepherded the way they needed to be. And so they those guys, which included Daniel Lewin, a top-notch Mossad assassin who was on Flight 11, these guys then, you know, got the passengers out of the planes, probably, because cell phones won't work inside a Faraday cage of an airliner, at least not very well, even on the ground. And they took them out of the planes inside a hangar and selected passengers to make cell phone calls. And so the cell phone calls that have been reported, and in a couple of cases recorded, there's a stewardess from, I think, Flight 11, who you can actually listen to her call. These calls were full of all kinds of bizarre anomalies that showed they couldn't be authentic, but what the heck were they? Well, now we know. All of those anomalies make perfect sense if you assume that these people are being coerced and the plane has landed. They've been taken off the plane by paramilitaries. They've got a gun to their head or something. They're being forced to read from a script, basically. And that's where we got our cell phone calls, which were the only evidence about what supposedly happened in the air. And they were also the key part of the PSYOP, because they were used to convince the people that these evil Muslim hijackers with little box cutter knives had somehow been, you know, wreaking all this havoc and mayhem and slashing people's throats in the air, all this incredibly evil stuff. So that, you know, the Flight 93 script came from this. Everything came from this. So that's how they did it. They landed, they pointed guns at people's head, they forced a few people to make cell phone calls, and then they killed them.
Wow, merciless.
Well, that's a very small sacrifice for these people. Remember, you know, our whole Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted a nuclear war with Russia in 1962, and they were willing to lose 30 or even 50 million Americans if they could win the nuclear war. So if they're willing to sacrifice 30 or even 50 million people, you know, what's a couple of plane loads? Those planes were hardly even full. I mean, they were all about a quarter full. They purposely kept the planes relatively empty so they would easily be able to handle the handful of passengers on each plane. These people don't care about human life. You know, they blew up the towers with 3,000 people inside. They murdered 1 million people in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they're thinking strategically, and human lives are just pawns on their chessboard.
Yeah, evident. Got more questions for you. I got Jane in California wants to know if you think that ISIS actually set this pilot on fire.
Yeah, I just saw this story. You know, I'm slow with these exciting mainstream media, you know, propaganda stories. So I've been getting emails saying this looks fake, you know, but I haven't looked into it myself. So I have no idea, but it's part of the whole propaganda program, you know, whether or not somebody who thinks that they're actually a radical Muslim was involved in setting somebody on fire, which is possible. Either way, ISIS is basically part of the imperial propaganda apparatus. They trained at CIA bases in Jordan. ISIS fighters and Al-Qaeda fighters are regularly brought into Israel for medical treatment. Netanyahu visits them at the field hospitals. You know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are parts of the U.S. Israeli bankster military effort. So again, it was your tax. If that guy got burned, it was your tax dollars that did it.
Okay, another question from John in Kentucky. He wants to know, if the majorities of Muslims know the truth about 9/11, why do so few of the foreign leaders call out the U.S. government over the 9/11 public forums?
Well, I think the message has been sent that if you talk about 9/11 out of school, bad things might happen to you. For instance, let's see, there was President Cossiga of Italy said everybody knows that, this is after he was retired, he said everybody knows that it was a CIA Mossad operation, and then he died not very long after that. The message has been clearly sent. Immediately after 9/11, the CIA station chief in Istanbul, Turkey, Graham Fuller, who is a notorious deep state operative who's been involved with the drug smuggling, the setting up of terrorism, all this stuff, he visited all of the leading Turkish journalists in Turkey, or called them, and he told them that basically their families' lives would be in danger if they questioned the official story of 9/11. And I got that straight from the journalist when I was in Turkey. And that kind of message has been sent everywhere. So you have to be really brave to stand up and question 9/11 the way that President Ahmadinejad did. He went to the UN and questioned 9/11, and he just took a torrent of abuse from the media, and his country suffered because of his commitment to truth. Likewise, the former president of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, called 9/11 an inside job many times and helped convene the recent Malaysia Kuala Lumpur war crimes tribunals at which Israel was convicted of genocide. Well, right after that, Malaysian airliners started falling out of the sky. It's very, very clear that when you cross certain red lines, bad things might happen to you. You know, Danny Jawenko, the top European expert on controlled demolitions, called Building 7 a controlled demolition, and then a year or two later, he died in one of those very mysterious car crashes. So you have to be very brave. To, you know, 80% of the world's Muslims know it was an inside job. All the polls show this, and those polls understate the case. But who's going to stand up and say it in public, knowing that they personally will take serious consequences, possibly including death or death of their loved ones, and that their country will take very serious consequences?
Right.
Well.
I've got a caller from Scotland waiting on line 3. Let's get her through. Go ahead, Kendra.
Hello. I'm calling for Kendra in Scotland. What drew you to Islam, and how do you stay Muslim when all around the world there are women being brutalized, raped, and being punished for being raped, left out of inheritance, and the men continue jumping wife to wife, abandoning their wives and children, and leaving them to fend for themselves on welfare?
Well, it sounds like you've been reading your Zionist propaganda. Actually, if you look at the statistics, you'll find that the statistics show that family life among Muslims is far more stable, and male parental behavior is far more responsible on average than among non-Muslims. And the place to go to find the compendium of statistics is the book Muslims Most Civilized But Not Civilized Enough. And that book is by Dr. Javed Jamil, who was over in India. As far as this business of massive mistreatment of women in these various ways, virtually everything that gets cited anecdotally about Muslim mistreatment of women is coming from the Israeli propaganda apparatus. Virtually every story translated from the media of every Muslim country goes through MEMRI. MEMRI, M-E-M-R-I, is an Israeli Mossad propaganda outfit. It's actually technically private, but it was founded by former Mossad people. And their job is to comb the media of the Islamic world looking for stories that can be used to make Muslims look bad. And that's the only kind of stuff that ever gets translated and handed to the U.S. media, which is completely run by Islam-hating Zionists. So that's why you're hearing this stuff. The truth of the matter is that these problems, and there are problems with things like honor killings, but they're much worse among non-Muslims than Muslims. Honor killings are a problem in traditional cultures, patriarchal, tribal, traditional cultures, and by and large, they're worse among non-Muslim comparable cultures than among the Muslim ones. And in the cultures where they happen that are, you know, Islamic, it is the Islamists, the hardcore, pious, strongly Muslim Islamic activists who are working the hardest to stop them. So everything you've heard about this is wrong.
Then why are the rates of divorce going up in Muslims when you're saying defending them as if they're better than other religions?
Well, they were a lot better, but you're right. Unfortunately, in some places, the divorce rates among Muslims are rising. They're still nowhere near what they are among non-Muslims. Here in the United States, for example, with non-Muslims, it's about 50%, which is just atrocious. With Muslims, it's up past 25%, which is I think is also atrocious. It wasn't that way 10 years ago. Excuse me?
It's past 35%.
Past 35% now? Yeah, well, that's because they're losing Islam. You know, that's the problem, is the Muslims that come to America are not here to live Islamic lives. They're here to make money. And the people who left somewhere else and came here, in the U.S., we have a very, you know, they're very nice, they're middle class, they're well-educated, they're good citizens, but they're basically materialistic, and they're starting to become more like other Americans, and that's absolutely tragic. It's terrible. They need to stick with Islam, which means they will not divorce. Divorce is the most hated thing in the eyes of God that is not completely banned. And we need to keep Muslims all over the world so that their family structures will remain intact and they'll continue to do substantially better than non-Muslims on the average, as Dr. Jamil's statistics prove.
Great.
Thank you for going for the classic that it's all Zionist. Thank you.
Well, it is. Look who owns the media. Do a little internet research and tell me if you really think that only 2% of the key people in the media are Jewish Zionists. Jews are 2% of the population here in the United States, but it's more like 2% that aren't Jewish Zionists in terms of who runs Hollywood, and it's not that different in the rest of the media. I mean, it's just the truth. It's the facts. I mean, thank me for it if you thank me for telling the truth, or curse me for telling the truth. It's still the truth.
Great. There was one last question, but we don't have time to get it in. Thank you so much, Dr. Barrett, for being our guest here on The People Speak. We really enjoyed you this evening. Hopefully we'll have you back again after your book is done. Don't forget to join us here next week on The People Speak. Gloria Allred will be interviewed by one of our hosts. Join us here on The People Speak, where you get the truth and nothing but the truth.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.